prudent, habituated to the woods, and familiar with Indian manners and character. He is not regularly educated, but he possesses a great mass of accurate observation on all the subjects of nature which present themselves here, and will therefore readily select those only in his new route which shall be new. He has qualified himself for those observations of longitude and latitude necessary to fix the points of the line he will go over. Lewis still had much to learn. To that end, Jefferson had plans for him to do graduate work in Philadelphia with America's leading scientists. That Lewis would benefit, Jefferson had no doubt. That Lewis could simultaneously plan the expedition and begin putting it together, Jefferson had no doubts. Some of his advisers did. They considered Lewis not well educated and perhaps too strong-headed and too much of a risk-taker. But Jefferson was sure he had the right man. Chapter 7. Preparing for the Expedition. January to June, 1803. A week after Congress appropriated the funds for the expedition, Jefferson began writing his scientific friends. The message was the same in each case. The expedition has been authorized but is still confidential. I have chosen Captain Lewis to lead it. Lewis needs advice and instruction. The letters made it clear that Jefferson intended the recipients to provide advice and instruction without cost to the government. Lewis's schooling began during the period from New Year's Day to the Ides of March. Lewis was still living in the President's house, conferring with Jefferson as often and for as long as Jefferson's schedule would allow. Beyond the conferences and the practical lessons in the use of the sextant and other measuring instruments, which took place on the lawn, Lewis studied maps in Jefferson's collection. He also conferred with Albert Gallatin, a serious map collector. Gallatin had a special map made up for Lewis showing North America from the Pacific coast to the Mississippi, with details on what was known of the Missouri River up to the Mandan villages in the Great Bend of the river, today's Bismarck, North Dakota, and a few wild guesses as to what the Rockies might look like and the course of the Columbia. There were but three certain points on the map: the latitude and longitude of the mouth of the Columbia, of St. Louis, and of the Mandan villages, thanks to British fur traders. By the time he finished studying with Jefferson and Gallatin, Lewis knew all that there was to know about the Missouri and what lay to the west of it. The problem was that west of the Mandans, nearly to the coast, was terra incognita, and the best scientists in the world could not begin to fill in that map until someone had walked across the land, taking measurements, providing descriptions of the flora, fauna, rivers, mountains, and people, not failing to note the commercial and agricultural possibilities. To make that journey required a frontiersman's expert knowledge combined with an understanding of technology and what it could do to make the passage easier and more fruitful. That was the positive side of Jefferson's choice of Lewis, who was, in fact, the perfect choice. Indeed, Lewis's career might almost have been dedicated to preparing him for this adventure. He knew the old Northwest about as well as any man in the country. He knew lonely forest trails through Indian country. He knew hunting and fishing and canoes. He knew how to keep records, had adequate mathematical skills, and for 2 years had been privy to Mr. Jefferson's hopes and dreams, his curiosity and knowledge. Jefferson told Patterson that Lewis had the required frontier skills, to which he joins a great stock of accurate observation on the subjects of the three kingdoms. He has been for some time qualifying himself for taking observations of longitude and latitude to fix the geographical points of the line he will pass over. But he needed help, and it was Patterson's and the other scientists in Philadelphia's privilege and, not stated but clearly implied, duty to supply that help. Of course, they were all delighted to do so anyway. It was a favorite saying of one of President Jefferson's 20th century successors, Dwight Eisenhower, that in war, before the battle is joined, plans are everything, but once the shooting begins, plans are worthless. The same aphorism can be said about exploration. In battle, what cannot be predicted is the enemy's reaction. In exploration, what cannot be predicted is what is around the next bend in the river or on the other side of the hill. The planning process, therefore, is as much guesswork as it is intelligent forecasting of the physical needs of the expedition. It tends to be frustrating because the planner carries with him a nagging sense that he is making some simple mistakes that could be easily corrected in the planning stage, but may cause a dead loss when the mistake is discovered midway through the voyage. For this expedition, planning was going on at two levels. The president was working on the first draft of his instructions to Lewis. It was becoming a long, complex document, for Jefferson was making a list of the things he wanted to know about the West. Since there was so much he wanted to know, far more than a single expedition could answer, he had to make choices. There was no mention of looking for gold or silver in the draft Jefferson was circulating, for example, whereas soil conditions and climate were included. Trade possibilities were prominent. Taken altogether, the instructions represented a culmination and a triumph of the American Enlightenment. The expedition authorized by the popularly elected Congress would combine scientific, commercial, and agricultural concerns with geographical discovery and nation-building. All the pillars of Enlightenment thought, summed up with the phrase, useful knowledge, were gathering in the instructions. While Jefferson worked on the instructions, Lewis had his own planning to do. Jefferson would set the objectives, but it was Captain Lewis who would get the expedition there and back. The responsibility was his for deciding the size of the expedition, how it would proceed up the Missouri River, what it would need to cross the Rocky Mountains and descend the Columbia to the Pacific Ocean and return. The team would have to do this as a self-contained unit. Once the expedition left St. Louis, Lewis would be stuck with the decisions he had made during the planning process. How many men? With what skills? How big a boat? What design? What type of rifle? How much powder and lead? How many cooking pots? What tools? How much dry or salted rations could be carried? What medicines in what quantity? What scientific instruments? What books? How many fishing hooks? How much salt, tobacco, whiskey? Lewis and Jefferson talked into the late evening about such questions. Jefferson thought it would be a good idea to carry some cast-iron corn mills to give the Indians as presents. Lewis agreed. They discussed the trade beads that were the currency of the western Indian tribes and agreed that plenty would be needed. They made up lists of other items. Together, they concocted the idea of a collapsible iron frame boat, one that could be carried past the falls of the Missouri, wherever that might be, and put together at the far end with animal skins to cover it, so that the expedition would be back in business on the water. They talked about timing. Now that the appropriation was in hand, both men wanted to get started as soon as possible. With the coming of spring and the drying of the roads, Lewis wanted to be ready to go. He told Jefferson he hoped to be across the Appalachians by early summer. He intended to go to the post at Southwest Post, near present Kingston in eastern Tennessee, and there enlist his core group of soldier explorers from the garrison. He planned to march them overland to Nashville, where he would pick up a previously ordered keelboat to float down the Cumberland River to its junction with the Ohio, not far above the Ohio's junction with the Mississippi. He planned to be in St. Louis by August 1st and thought he might be able to proceed a good bit of the way up the Missouri before being forced into winter camp. In 1804, he expected to cross the mountains, reach the Pacific, make the return journey, and report back before winter set in. Lewis and Jefferson talked through January and February and on into March, trying to imagine what the trip was going to be like so that they could be certain of what would be needed. But that was only the half of it. The other half involved preparing Lewis for the scientific observations he would be responsible for making. That meant study. Hard, intensive study in a variety of disciplines under a severe time pressure. On the Ides of March, Lewis left Washington for Harper's Ferry, site of the U.S. Army's arsenal. Lewis's purpose was to obtain arms and ammunition for his party. He could select from existing stock or order items made special for the expedition by the arsenal's craftsmen. He carried a letter to the superintendent of the arsenal from Secretary of War Dearborn. "You will be pleased to make such arms and ironwork as requested by the bearer, Captain Meriwether Lewis, and to have them completed with the least possible delay." When he had what was needed, he would arrange for it to be shipped to Pittsburgh, then hurry on to Philadelphia for more schooling and shopping. At Harper's Ferry, he got 15 muzzle-loading, flintlock, long-barreled rifles, sometimes called Kentucky, but more properly, Pennsylvania rifles. They were the sine qua non of the expedition. On them depended the food supply and self-defense. They were absolutely dependable. The U.S. Model 1803, the first rifle specifically designed for the U.S. Army, 54 caliber with a 33-inch barrel. Lewis referred to these weapons as short rifles, for they were considerably shorter than the civilian Pennsylvania rifle. The Model 1803 delivered a lead slug on target with sufficient velocity to kill a deer at a range of about 100 yards. An expert could get off 2 aimed shots in 1 minute. Lewis also selected pipe tomahawks and ordered the artisans at Harper's Ferry to make 3 dozen. He picked up fish gigs, knives, and so on. Mainly, however, he supervised the construction of the iron boat frame. It was so important to him that he stayed on at Harper's Ferry for a month instead of the week he had planned. This was cutting into the time Jefferson had wanted him to spend in Philadelphia. On April 22nd, having heard nothing from Lewis since March 7th, Jefferson learned in reports from others about Lewis's delay at Harper's Ferry. With Lewis gone, the president needed a secretary. He had selected a young man, Lewis Harvey of Virginia, but had put off announcing the appointment for reasons he explained in a letter to Harvey. Jefferson had been living in the daily expectation that the stage of the day would bring back Captain Lewis, and that then, within a few days, he would set out on his Mississippi expedition. Jefferson also said that he had put off writing because my great regard for Captain Lewis made me unwilling to show a haste to fill his place before he was gone, and to counteract also a malignant and unfounded report that I was parting with him from dissatisfaction, a thing impossible either from his conduct or my dispositions toward him. Washington will have its gossip. Jefferson was extremely sensitive to it, but far more important to him was Lewis's delay. He was almost desperate because of it, but he subdued his feelings and wrote Lewis with some care in his word choices. I have no doubt you have used every possible exertion to get off, and therefore we have only to lament what cannot be helped, as the delay of a month now may lose a year in the end. Lewis might have read that as an expression of confidence, but on second reading wondered if it was a complaint. Most likely the former. In any case, he knew Jefferson would understand and would agree with his judgment on priorities. Jefferson's letter of complaint crossed Lewis's explanation for the delay, a frequent occurrence given the maddeningly slow mails. Lewis described his activities. Besides arranging for the rifles, knives, and other equipment, he had written to the commander at Southwest Post to request help in getting suitable volunteers. The soldier volunteers could be promised their regular pay and a reward of land grants. Lewis anticipated gathering his party as he made his way to St. Louis that summer, and strengthening it through personnel selection as the expedition proceeded, rejecting the weak, ignorant, and unmanageable for the strong, skilled, and eager volunteers. He told Jefferson he intended to be ruthless about it. He had written to a congressman from Tennessee requesting that he find a boat builder in Nashville who could make a boat and a canoe for the expedition. These and other matters took longer than he had expected. But by far the biggest cause of delay was Lewis's experimenting with the boat he and Jefferson had dreamed up. Every day he was at the worksite because he was convinced that without his personal attention, the workmen would never understand the design. He carried out some sophisticated experiments with 2 different designs, one curved, the other semi-cylindrical, the former for the stem and stern, the latter for the body of the boat. He triumphantly reported to Jefferson that the frame would weigh only 44 pounds, whereas the boat, when covered with hide, would carry 1,770 pounds. Lewis told Jefferson, "I was induced from the result of this experiment to direct the iron frame of the canoe to be completed." He had made his first important independent decisions, where to spend his fast-disappearing time, and what boat to build. This was the beginning of a new relationship with Jefferson. Though Lewis was not yet quite out of the reach of the president's communiques, he was not far short of it. Witness his decision to stay 3 extra weeks at Harper's Ferry, despite his knowledge that Jefferson desperately wanted him to get to Philadelphia to study, and then get on the road. In mid-April, Lewis set off to the east. He stopped first in Frederickstown, where on April 15th he wrote General William Irvin, superintendent of military stores, with headquarters in Philadelphia. Lewis said he wanted Irvin to purchase for him some necessary articles. First on the list was portable soup, a dried soup of various beans and vegetables that Lewis may have used during his travels as an army paymaster. In any case, he was enthusiastic about it. He told Irvin, "Portable soup, in my opinion, forms one of the most essential articles in the preparation for the expedition, and fearing that it cannot be procured readily in such quantity as is requisite, I take the liberty to request that you will procure 200 pounds of it for me," or however much was available on the market. "I have supposed that the soup would cost about $1 per pound. Should it, however, come much higher, then quantity must be limited by the sum of 250 pounds, as more cannot be expended." In the end, Lewis spent $289.50 on 193 pounds of portable soup, by far the highest sum for any area of provisions. He spent as much for dried soup as he had originally estimated for his instruments, arms, and ammunition. On April 19th, Lewis arrived in Lancaster. He went immediately to the home of Andrew Ellicott, America's leading astronomer and mathematician. Jefferson had earlier written Ellicott to ask him to teach Lewis to make celestial observations, and Ellicott had replied, "Mr. Lewis's first object must be to acquire a facility and dexterity in making the observations, which can only be obtained by practice." Lewis and Ellicott wasted no time. On April 20th, Lewis reported to Jefferson, "I have commenced, under his direction, my observations, etc., to perfect myself in the use and application of the instruments." He found Ellicott to be extremely friendly and attentive, and I am confident is disposed to render me every aid in his power. He thinks it will be necessary I should remain here 10 or 12 days. While at Lancaster, Lewis picked up additional rifles. How many is not known, nor why he couldn't get all he wanted at Harper's Ferry. They may have been improved models, since Lancaster was the manufacturing center for long rifles. But his list of necessary items and of quantities required continued to grow, indicating that at Harper's Ferry he had decided the expedition had to be a party considerably larger than a dozen men. Another thought had come into his head, that another officer would be required. No evidence exists as to when or even if he discussed either of these critical matters with Jefferson, but how could he have failed to do so? Lewis's schooling in Lancaster in the use of sextant, chronometer, and other instruments took longer than Ellicott had anticipated. Not until May 7th was he ready to go to Philadelphia. The ride from Lancaster to Philadelphia took him over the most modern highway in America, completed in 1795, made of broken stone, the country's first gravel road. Stage wagons were able to average 5 to 7 miles per hour on it. Going that fast in a stage was a new experience for Lewis. In Philadelphia, he went to Patterson, who continued his instruction. With Patterson's help, he selected a chronometer. He bought it from Thomas Parker, a clock and watchmaker on South 3rd Street, for $250, by far the largest sum expended for any single item carried on the expedition. Lewis sent it to Ellicott to be regulated with this note: "I have at length been enabled to procure a chronometer which you will receive, and you will also receive with her a screwdriver and key. The inner cases of the chronometer are confined by a screw. She is wound up and the works are stopped by inserting a hog's bristle, which you will discover by examination. She has been cleaned by Mr. Voigt and her rate of going ascertained by observation to be 14 minutes too slow in 24 hours. Jefferson sent Lewis a current draft of his instructions, asking Lewis to comment and to circulate the draft among the various savants in Philadelphia for their comments and suggestions. Lewis worried about a phrase in the draft that indicated that the scientific instruments had already been provided. By whom, he wondered. What were they? He asked Jefferson for a list so that he could consult with Patterson and Ellicott to make certain nothing had been omitted. He further informed Jefferson that his teachers both disapprove of the theodolite, which Jefferson had told Lewis would be his best instrument for accurate measurements. It was a delicate instrument, difficult of transportation, and one that would be very liable to get out of order. And anyway, it was much more inaccurate than the sextant. his teachers agreed on what instruments would be indispensably necessary. They were 2 sextants, an artificial horizon or two, a good Arnold's watch or chronometer, a surveyor's compass with a ball and socket and 2-pole chain, and a set of plotting instruments. There was just a hint of a reminder in the letter that the decision-making power for the expedition was coming into Lewis's hands. Jefferson acknowledged as much in his reply, regretting the impression which has been misunderstood. The draft Lewis had of the instructions would not be dated until the day he departed. Jefferson had assumed that by then Lewis would have made his selections and purchases. As to the theodolite, Jefferson told Lewis to do whatever Patterson and Ellicott recommended. Lewis was in Philadelphia through much of May and the first week in June. He made the rounds of the city, the list he and Jefferson had drawn up in hand, making purchases. Fishing tackle, lead canisters, medicines, dry goods, tobacco, shirts. He spent $2,324. Herewith, a sampling of the items he purchased. 6 papers of ink powder, sets of pencils, crayons, 200 pounds of best rifle powder, and 400 pounds of lead, 4 gross fishing hooks assorted, 25 axes, woolen overalls and other clothing items, including 30 yards common flannel, 100 flints, 30 steels for striking or making fire, 6 large needles and 6 dozen large awls, 3 bushels of salt. He bought oilskin bags to protect the instruments and journals. He got mosquito netting and field tables and large multipurpose sheets of oiled linen, each 8 by 12 feet, for tents, and candles so that he could write at night. The sheets of oiled linen could double up as sails by day. For Indian presents, 5 pounds of white glass beads, mostly small, and 20 pounds of red assorted beads, 144 small cheap scissors, 288 common brass thimbles, 10 pounds of assorted sewing thread, silk, paint and vermilion, 288 knives, combs, armbands, and ear trinkets. Lewis insisted on taking a preponderance of blue beads because they were far more valued than the white beads of the same manufacture and answer all the purposes of money. The emphasis was on the gay and gaudy rather than the useful. Although Lewis called them presents, they were trade goods. He did not intend to give them away. Rather, he would use them to purchase goods and services from the Indians. Lewis and Clark scholar Paul Russell Cutright writes, "It was no small task to anticipate all that he would need in the way of arms, food, clothing, camping paraphernalia, scientific instruments, and Indian presents for a party of still undetermined size that, for an indefinite period of time, would be out of touch with normal supply sources." How well he had done, only the event could tell. One small peek ahead is appropriate here, however, because it reveals so much about Lewis and the point of view he held. During the expedition, the party ran out of many useful or pleasure-giving items, including tobacco, whiskey, salt, and blue beads. A frontiersman could live without those things. The expedition ran short of, but never out of, many critical items. But when it got home, the expedition had sufficient powder and lead to repeat the journey, and plenty of rifles. Lewis had arranged at Harper's Ferry for lead canisters that, when melted down, made exactly the right number of balls for the amount of powder in the canister. Lewis had the frontiersman's faith in his rifle. As long as a man had his rifle, ammunition, and powder, he would take on anything the wilderness could throw at him. Lewis also had plenty of ink left when he got home, enough for another voyage. That ink wasn't critical to making the trip, but it was critical to making the expedition a success by recording its findings. Lewis had his priorities right. The purchase of the soup was a serious cost overrun. Along with the extra rifles he purchased in Lancaster, the amount indicates that the more he thought about what he might encounter, the larger the size of the party was becoming in his imagination. The amounts of medicine he purchased also indicate he now planned to take many more than a dozen men. His medical advisor was Dr. Benjamin Rush, a member of the American Philosophical Society, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and the most eminent American physician of the day. On May 17th, Lewis called on him at his home on the corner of Walnut and 4th Streets, bringing along Jefferson's draft instructions for Rush's comments. They talked. Rush gave advice, beginning with, "When you feel the least indisposition, do not attempt to overcome it by labor or marching. Rest in a horizontal posture. Also, fasting and diluting drinks for a day or two will generally prevent an attack of fever. To these preventatives of disease may be added a gentle sweat obtained by warm drinks or gently opening the bowels by means of one, two, or more of the purging pills. Those pills were under Dr. Rush's patent, known as Rush's pills, but generally referred to as thunderclappers. As far as Rush was concerned, they were sovereign for nearly all mankind's ills. They were composed of calomel, a mixture of 6 parts mercury to 1 part chlorine, and jalap. Each drug was a purgative of explosive power. The combination was awesome. Mercury had an even more important role in Lewis's pharmacy. It was the treatment of choice for syphilis, and remained so until the advent of penicillin during World War II. Another piece of advice from Dr. Rush: after long marches or much fatigue from any cause, you will be more refreshed by lying down in a horizontal posture for 2 hours than by resting a much longer time in any other position of the body. There is no evidence of Lewis's asking the good doctor what he thought they would be encountering out there. Lewis reported to Jefferson, "Dr. Rush has favored me with some abstract queries under the several heads of physical history, medicine, morals, and religion of the Indians, which I have no doubt will be serviceable in directing my inquiries among that people." Rush's questionnaire asked about the diseases of the Indians and their remedies, at what age menstruation began and ended, the age of marriage, how long they suckled their children, the state of the pulse in the morning, at noon, and at night, before and after eating. At what time did they rise? What about baths, murder, suicide? Do they employ any substitute for ardent spirits to promote intoxication? Any animal sacrifices in their religion? What affinity between their religious ceremonies and those of the Jews? Here, Rush was looking for the fabled lost tribe of Israel. More realistically, how do they dispose of their dead, and with what ceremonies do they inter them? It was an eclectic list of questions, some silly, some stunningly on the mark. They illustrated how little could even be guessed about the nature of the Indian tribes of the West, or their numbers. In addition to the questionnaire, Rush prepared a medical list for Lewis, amounting to $90.69 for drugs, lancets, forceps, syringes, and other supplies. It included 50 dozen Rush's pills, along with 30 other kinds of drugs. Those most used were Peruvian bark, jalap, opium, glauber salts, nitre, i.e. potassium nitrate or saltpeter, tartar emetic, laudanum, calomel, and mercurial ointment. The drugs Lewis bought contained 1,300 doses of physic, 1,100 of emetic, 3,500 of diaphoretic, sweat inducer, and more, including drugs for blistering, salivation, and increased kidney output, along with tourniquets and clister syringes. While at Harper's Ferry, Lewis had thought of bringing a doctor along, but by May he evidently had decided he himself would be the doctor. He had learned from his mother a great deal about herbs and simples and herb therapy, and wasn't afraid to experiment. Like all frontiersmen, he knew how to set a broken bone or remove an embedded bullet or arrow, how to cope with croup or dysentery. Rush was impressed by Lewis. He wrote Jefferson, "His mission is truly interesting. I shall wait with great solicitude for its issue. Mr. Lewis appears admirably qualified for it. May its advantages prove no less honorable to your administration than to the interests of science." It wasn't all work. Lewis did a considerable amount of socializing in Philadelphia with his friend Malan Dickerson. They moved in the highest social circles. Dinner one evening with Jefferson's great friend Dr. George Logan, another evening with Governor Thomas McKean at his mansion on the northeast corner of 3rd and Pine Streets. By day, Lewis expanded his studies. He went to Dr. Benjamin Smith Barton, professor at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the first textbook on botany in the United States, just published when Lewis came to him. Barton lived a few steps from Independence Hall at 44 North 5th Street. He had studied in England and Germany, and he had made fairly extensive field trips in Pennsylvania. He was mesmerized by the expedition. The thought of all that was waiting to be discovered tempted him so much that he talked with Lewis about the possibility of going along. Lewis was enthusiastic about the idea. Barton would certainly be an asset in collecting and describing, but he was 37 years old, a scholar, not a soldier. I fear the doctor will not carry this design into effect, Lewis told Jefferson, rightly, as it turned out. Still, Barton made important contributions. He taught Lewis how to preserve specimens, either plant or bird or animal skin. He taught Lewis the importance of specimen labels, including place and date of collection. Barton expanded Lewis's vocabulary and range of knowledge. In a painstaking study on the scientific writing of Lewis, Elijah Criswell compiled a list of almost 200 different technical terms the captain employed in describing new plants and animals, a quantity showing, in Criswell's words, a remarkable knowledge for an amateur of scientific, especially botanical, descriptive terminology. Dr. Caspar Wister was the last of the Philadelphia savants Lewis turned to for education. Wister held the chair of anatomy at the University of Pennsylvania and had published the first American textbook on anatomy. He was also a member of the American Philosophical Society and the foremost authority on fossils in America. He talked with Lewis about that anomalous beast, the Megalonyx, which he and Jefferson had discovered, and about the mastodons he and Jefferson believed might still inhabit the prairies. One last thing Lewis got in Philadelphia, his traveling library. It included Barton's Elements of Botany, which was not a gift. Lewis paid $6 for it. Lewis borrowed a book from Barton, Antoine Simor Lepage Duprat's History of Louisiana. He had Richard Kirwan's Elements of Mineralogy, London, 1784, a two-volume edition of Linnaeus, the founder of the system of Latin classification of plants, and a four-volume dictionary, along with a practical introduction to spherics and nautical astronomy, and the nautical almanac and astronomical ephemeris, together with tables necessary to finding latitude and longitude. On May 29th, Lewis sent a long-overdue report to Jefferson. He announced that on June 6th or 7th he would be able to depart for Washington for a final conference, then would be off. He would have all his preparations completed in a day or two, but wanted to stay on an extra few days for additional study with Patterson. He enclosed some tracings he had made of Vancouver's map of the northwestern coast. He explained why a tracing rather than the original. The maps attached to Vancouver's voyage cannot be procured separately from that work, which is both too costly and too weighty for me either to purchase or carry. Geographer John Logan Allen points out that it took considerable cartographic technique to copy the charts from Vancouver's work. Lewis, Allen writes, was not simply a passive receptor of the geographical materials being assembled by Jefferson and Gallatin. It seems, rather, that he was active in gathering data for the purpose of taking it along on the expedition. Dr. Allen further speculates, on the basis of internal evidence, that Lewis made a copy of the David Thompson map of the Great Bend of the Missouri River, done late in the last century and in the possession of the British Chargé d'Affaires in Washington. During the second week in June, Lewis abandoned his original plan to go by Southwest Post. He had heard there were too few good men in the garrison and that no boat would be waiting in Nashville. So he arranged transportation by the Army, at the Army's expense, for 3,500 pounds of goods to be moved from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh. Because the road which from necessity they must travel is by no means good, Lewis ordered a 5-horse team to pull the wagon. Apparently it was also at this time that he entered into a contract with a boat builder in Pittsburgh. Then he set off for Washington. Probably foremost in Lewis's mind was the size of the party, along with an inevitable need for a second officer. None had been mentioned, but Lewis wanted one. If Jefferson approved, Lewis had a candidate in mind, as well as a highly unusual command arrangement. The president and the captain also needed to go over the final instructions in detail. Jefferson needed to bring Lewis up to date on the status of the proposed purchase of New Orleans. The two men had a lot to talk about before Lewis headed west. Chapter 8. Washington to Pittsburgh, June to August, 1803. When Lewis arrived in Washington, he and Jefferson went to work immediately on the instructions. Jefferson had circulated them among his cabinet and had their replies to consider. Secretary of State James Madison had wondered, if the laws give any authority at present beyond the limits of the U.S.? That was a shorthand way of raising the point that this expedition was going into territory belonging to France and administered by Spain, whose governments might regard it as a military reconnaissance or even an invasion. Attorney General Levi Lincoln warned Jefferson that because of the perverse, hostile, and malignant state of the opposition, with their facility of imposing on the public mind and producing excitements, every measure originating with the executive will be attacked with a virulence, including the expedition. For his part, Lincoln declared, "I consider the enterprise of national consequence." But as a politician, Lincoln knew that more justification was needed to keep the Federalist from howling at the cost. He came up with a rationale that would appeal to the New England clergy, advertised the thing as a mission to elevate the religious beliefs of the heathen Indians. "If the enterprise appears to be an attempt to advance them, it will by many people on that account be justified, however calamitous the issue." Jefferson bought the idea. In his final instructions, he ordered Lewis to learn what he could about Indian religion, because it would help those who may endeavor to civilize and instruct them. Lincoln had another important suggestion. Jefferson had written that if Lewis were faced with certain destruction, he should retreat rather than offer opposition. Lincoln commented, "From my ideas of Captain Lewis, he will be much more likely, in case of difficulty, to push too far rather than to recede too soon. Would it not be well to change the term certain destruction into probable destruction, and to add that these dangers are never to be encountered, which vigilance, precaution, and attention can secure against at a reasonable expense?" There is more than a hint here that Lincoln was one of the president's advisers who feared Lewis was a reckless risk-taker, one of those Virginia gentlemen who would overreact to any challenge to his honor or bravery. Jefferson may have agreed. In any event, he adopted the wording Lincoln suggested. Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin saw nothing in Jefferson's draft that needed changing, but he did want some things added. He wanted to know more about the Spanish posts in Louisiana and the British activities along the Missouri River. "The future destinies of the Missouri country are of vast importance to the U.S., Gallatin wrote, "it being perhaps the only large tract of country, and certainly the first, which, lying out of the boundaries of the Union, will be settled by the people of the United States." Therefore, he wanted as much information as possible on the Missouri drainage. As the instructions indicated, Jefferson had a multitude of motives for sending off the expedition, but number one for him was the all-water route to the Pacific. Not for Gallatin. He flatly stated, "The great object is to ascertain whether from its extent and fertility the Missouri country is susceptible of a large population, in the same manner as the corresponding tract on the Ohio." He wanted Lewis enjoined to describe the soil and make judgments on its fertility by noticing the prevailing species of timber, to assess annual rainfall, temperature extremes, and other factors important to farmers. Jefferson adopted most of Gallatin's suggestions, but in its final form, the instructions issued by Commander-in-Chief Jefferson to Captain Meriwether Lewis put exploration and commerce ahead of agriculture. "The object of your mission," Jefferson wrote, "is to explore the Missouri River and such principal stream of it as, by its course and communication with the waters of the Pacific Ocean, whether the Columbia, Oregon, Colorado, or any other river, may offer the most direct and practicable water communication across this continent for the purposes of commerce." Commerce being the principal object, Jefferson naturally wanted Lewis to learn what he could about the routes used by the British traders coming down from Canada to trade with the Missouri River tribes, and about their trading methods and practice. He wanted Lewis to make suggestions as to how the fur trade, currently dominated by the British, could be taken over by Americans using the Missouri route. Good maps were essential to commerce, so Jefferson's orders read, "Beginning at the mouth of the Missouri, you will take careful observations of latitude and longitude at all remarkable points on the river, and especially at the mouths of rivers, at rapids, at islands, and other places and objects distinguished by such natural marks and characters of a durable kind." Jefferson admonished Lewis to write his figures and observations distinctly and intelligibly, and to make multiple copies, one of these to be on the paper of the birch, as less liable to injury from damp than common paper. The fur trade would require knowledge of the Indian tribes. Jefferson instructed Lewis to learn the names of the nations and their numbers, the extent of their possessions, their relations with other tribes, their languages, traditions, monuments, their occupations, whether agriculture or fishing or hunting or war, and the implements they used for those activities, their food, clothing, and housing, the diseases prevalent among them, and the remedies they used, their laws and customs, and last on the list, but first in importance, articles of commerce they may need or furnish, and to what extent. This was an ethnographer's dream-come-true set of marching orders. In all your intercourse with the natives, Jefferson went on, treat them in the most friendly and conciliatory manner which their own conduct will admit. Lewis should satisfy them of your journey's innocence, but simultaneously tell them of the size and strength of the United States. He should temper that implied threat by assuring the tribes of our wish to be neighborly and of our peaceful intentions. Americans only wish to trade with them. Lewis should invite a few chiefs to come to Washington for a visit and arrange for some Indian children to come to the United States and be brought up with us and taught such arts as may be useful to them. On the distinct possibility of an Indian attack, Jefferson was specific. If faced by a superior force determined to stop the expedition, you must decline its further pursuit and return. In the loss of yourselves, we should lose also the information you will have acquired. To your own discretion, therefore, must be left the degree of danger you may risk, and the point at which you should decline, only saying we wish you to err on the side of your safety, and to bring back your party safe, even if it be with less information. Jefferson told Lewis that, on the accident of your death, you are hereby authorized to name the person who shall succeed to the command. When Lewis reached the Pacific coast, he should seek out a European trading vessel and possibly sail back to the United States on it. Or he could send back a copy of the journals with two men, if he wished, and return by the route he had come. Taken altogether, the military section of Jefferson's orders was all that a company commander setting off on an expedition could hope for. He had the authority he needed, including the specific permission from the commander-in-chief to make his judgments in the field. Jefferson realized that when Lewis reached the Pacific, you will be without money, clothes, or provisions. To deal with that situation, Jefferson provided a letter of credit for Lewis, authorizing him to draw on any agency of the U.S. government anywhere in the world, anything he wanted. I also ask of the consuls, agents, merchants, and citizens of any nation to furnish you with those supplies which your necessities may call for, and to give more entire satisfaction and confidence to those who may be disposed to aid you, I, Thomas Jefferson, President of the United States of America, have written this letter of general credit for you with my own hand and signed it with my name. In its final version, dated July 4, 1803, this must be the most unlimited letter of credit ever issued by an American president. Beyond commerce, the purpose of the expedition was to discover flora and fauna. The instructions ordered Lewis to notice and comment on the soil, the plant and animal life, especially plants not known in the United States, dinosaur bones, and volcanoes. Jefferson wanted to know about mineral productions of every kind, but the ones he listed were limestone, pit coal, and salt. There is no direct order to keep a daily journal. Jefferson did write about the possibility of sending Indians down the Missouri to St. Louis, carrying letters and a copy of your journal, notes, and observations, the only use of the word journal in the instructions, and he did tell Lewis to send a copy of your notes by sea if he could, but there is no order about journal keeping. Perhaps it was a taken-for-granted matter. Perhaps, in their many long discussions about the instructions, Jefferson made the order orally. Donald Jackson's description of Jefferson's instructions cannot be bettered. They embrace years of study and wonder, the collected wisdom of his government colleagues and his Philadelphia friends. They barely conceal his excitement at realizing that at last he would have facts, not vague guesses, about the Stony Mountains, the river courses, the wild Indian tribes, the flora and fauna of untrodden places. As they talked about the instructions, Lewis and Jefferson also discussed such matters as when Lewis could get going, what additional instruments and maps he would need, the size of the party and additional supplies, what the War Department could contribute to the expedition, and the negotiations over Louisiana. All these subjects were intermingled. They came together in the need for another officer. Recognition of that need evidently came simultaneously. It certainly came naturally. The arguments for such an appointment were overwhelming. The instructions called for information in so many areas that one man could hardly provide it all and certainly could not do it all well. It was plain common sense to have two officers, so that if something happened to one, the other could bring back the maps, scientific discoveries, descriptions of the Indians encountered, and all the rest. A second officer would be a help in enforcing discipline and in fighting Indians if it came to that. There was no good reason not to take a second officer, except cost. And since Jefferson had just authorized spending millions of dollars for New Orleans, and he had his whole heart and mind invested in the Lewis expedition, he wasn't going to let cost be a factor. Jefferson opened the coffers of the War Department for Lewis, acting in his capacity as commander-in-chief in support of an expedition sanctioned by Congress. In the process, he stretched the Constitution considerably, but penny-pinching the expedition was worse than bending his strict constructionist principles. He told the War Department to pay Lewis an 18-month advance in his salary, possibly for land speculation or to pay off debts. Lewis also borrowed $108 from Jefferson. Secretary of War Henry Dearborn had sent an order to Harper's Ferry to supply anything Lewis requested in the way of arms and ironwork, with the least possible delay. Jefferson saw to it that Lewis had unlimited purchasing power. The chief clerk of the War Department received orders to purchase when requested by Lewis such articles as he may have occasion for, which he has not been able to obtain from the public stores, and the Treasury Department was ordered to turn over $1,000 for Lewis's goods. Even with some smoke and mirrors bookkeeping, the cost overrun was now at 100% and growing daily. Making the selections took time. Jefferson had hoped that Lewis would be off by June 28th or even earlier, but the day came and went, and Lewis still had much to do. Nevertheless, Lewis expected to be on the Missouri by September 1st, which would give him 2 traveling months, during which he hoped to go 700 or even 800 miles up the Missouri before going into winter quarters. On June 29th, Dearborn ordered the Army paymaster to give Lewis $554. Being 6 months' pay for 1 lieutenant, 1 sergeant, 1 corporal, and 10 privates. That amounted to Lewis's official authorization to add an officer. Lewis had already acted on it because Jefferson had agreed within a day or so of Lewis's arrival in Washington that it had to be done. On June 19th, Lewis had written to William Clark. The letter contained what Donald Jackson described as one of the most famous invitations to greatness the nation's archives can provide. It is a critical document. It launched one of the great friendships of all time and started the friends on one of the great adventures and one of the great explorations of all time. It is also revealing. Lewis and Clark have become so entwined by history that for many Americans the name is Lewis and Clark, but in 1803 they were not intimate friends. Although Clark was born in Virginia 4 years earlier than Lewis, he had moved to Kentucky as a small boy. They knew each other only in the Army, for 6 months, when Lewis had served under Clark. No anecdotes survive, or any correspondence between them in the next decade except for a business letter from Lewis to Clark, asking him to make inquiries about land in Ohio. But in that 6 months together, they had taken each other's measure. That they liked what they saw is obvious from Lewis's letter to Clark and Clark's response. They complimented each other. Clark was a tough woodsman, accustomed to command. He had been a company commander and had led a party down the Mississippi as far as Natchez. He had a way with enlisted men without ever getting familiar. He was a better terrestrial surveyor than Lewis and a better waterman. Lewis apparently knew of his map-making ability. In general, in areas in which Lewis was shaky, Clark was strong, and vice versa. Most of all, Lewis knew that Clark was competent to the task, that his word was his bond, that his back was steel. Clark knew the same about Lewis. Their trust in each other was complete, even before they took the first step west together. How this closeness came about cannot be known in any detail, but that it clearly was there long before the expedition cannot be doubted. Clark had retired from the Army in 1796, partly for reasons of health, partly to try his hand in business, mainly to do something to help straighten out the terribly tangled financial affairs of his older brother, General George Rogers Clark. He was living in Clarksville, Indiana Territory, when Lewis's letter arrived. Lewis opened his invitation thus. From the long and uninterrupted friendship and confidence which has subsisted between us, I feel no hesitation in making to you the following communication. He described the origins of the expedition, the congressional action, what he had done in Harper's Ferry and Philadelphia to get ready, and his intention to set out for Pittsburgh at the end of June. He thought he would be in Clarksville to meet Clark about August 10th. On the way, he intended to find and engage some good hunters, stout, healthy, unmarried men, accustomed to the woods and capable of bearing bodily fatigue in a pretty considerable degree. Should any young men answering this description be found in your neighborhood, I would thank you to give information of them on my arrival at the Falls of the Ohio. Lewis described the expedition in matter-of-fact language that may well have left Clark breathless. My plan is to descend the Ohio in a keeled boat, thence up the Mississippi to the mouth of the Missouri, and up that river as far as its navigation is practicable with a keeled boat, there to prepare canoes of bark or rawhides, and proceed to its, the Missouri's, source, and, if practicable, pass over to the waters of the Columbia or Oregon River, and by descending it, reach the Western Ocean. Lewis wrote that he would return to the United States on a trading vessel, if possible. He gave Clark a summary of his instructions from Jefferson and described the instruments he had collected for making observations. To carry out the mission, Lewis said he had authorization from Jefferson to pick non-commissioned officers and men, not to exceed 12, from the Western Army posts. He added that he was also authorized to engage any other man, not soldiers, that I may think useful in promoting the objects of success of this expedition. He had in mind hunters, guides, and interpreters. Thus, my friend, Lewis concluded, you have a summary view of the plan, the means, and the objects of this expedition. If, therefore, there is anything under those circumstances in this enterprise which would induce you to participate with me in its fatigues, its dangers, and its honors, believe me, there is no man on earth with whom I should feel equal pleasure in sharing them as with yourself. Lewis wrote that he had talked with Jefferson about the offer, and that the President expresses an anxious wish that you would consent to join me in this enterprise. There followed the most extraordinary offer. He, Jefferson, has authorized me to say that in the event of your accepting this proposition, he will grant you a captain's commission, which of course will entitle you to the pay and emoluments attached to that office, and will equally with myself entitle you to such portion of land as was granted to officers of similar rank for their revolutionary services. Your situation, if joined with me in this mission, will in all respects be precisely such as my own. It was remarkable for Lewis to propose a co-command. He did not even have to add a lieutenant to the party, and most certainly did not have to share the command. Divided command almost never works and is the bane of all military men, to whom the sanctity of the chain of command is basic and the idea of two disagreeing commanders in a critical situation is anathema. But Lewis did it anyway. It must have felt right to him. It had to have been based on what he knew about Clark and what he felt for him. Lewis wanted Clark along, even if not as an official member of the party. He closed his letter by saying that, if personal or business or any other affairs prevented Clark from accepting, Lewis hoped that he could accompany me as a friend part of the way up the Missouri. I should be extremely happy in your company. It would take a month for Lewis's letter to reach Clark, another 10 days for his reply to arrive. Meanwhile, a mystery. 10 days after Lewis made his offer of a shared command to Clark, he received from Secretary Dearborn the advance pay for the party to be recruited. It authorized one lieutenant only. Lewis made no known protest. Jefferson should have been alert enough to notice that Dearborn was thinking lieutenant while Lewis was offering captain, and he should have corrected the situation by telling Dearborn that Lewis's offer would prevail, and Clark, if he accepted, would be a captain. But the commander-in-chief did nothing. It was uncharacteristic of Lewis and Jefferson to miss a detail of any kind, much less one fraught with such potential danger for embarrassment, misunderstanding, and bad feeling, but they missed this one. Lewis spent the last week of June buying supplies and instruments, gathering more books, and going over maps. He made arrangements for a stand-in as his fellow officer, should Clark decline. He chose a man he had met in 1799 and served with, Lieutenant Moses Hook, and assured Jefferson that Hook was the best officer in the Army. Endowed with a good constitution, possessing a sensible, well-informed mind, is industrious, prudent, and persevering, and withal intrepid and enterprising. Lewis didn't hand out praise easily, and since it was clear that he was ready to cross the continent with Hook, he obviously meant what he said about Hook's superior abilities, but there was no hint of a promotion to captain and a co-command. Good as Hook was, he wasn't William Clark. By July 2nd, Lewis was nearing completion of the preparations and about to set off for Pittsburgh. That day, he wrote his mother. He opened with an apology for not having the time to come home for a visit before departing for the Western country, a trip he expected to take about a year and a half. As boys setting off on an adventure are wont to do, he reassured his mother. "The nature of this expedition is by no means dangerous. My route will be altogether through tribes of Indians who are perfectly friendly to the United States. Therefore, consider the chances of life just as much in my favor on this trip as I should conceive them were I to remain at home." After telling his mother not to worry, he wrote of what being Mr. Jefferson's choice meant to him. "The charge of this expedition is honorable to myself as it is important to my country." Then it was back to reassurance. "I feel myself perfectly prepared, nor do I doubt my health and strength of constitution to bear me through it. I go with the most perfect preconviction in my own mind of returning safe, and hope, therefore, that you will not suffer yourself to indulge any anxiety for my safety." There followed a series of instructions on the education of Lewis's half-brother, John Marks. Lewis insisted that John go to the College of William and Mary at Williamsburg, even if land certificates had to be sold to pay the tuition. Given how deeply Virginia planters hated to sell land, Lewis's priorities show the high value he set on education. After the crash courses he had been put through in Philadelphia, he had reason to wish he had gone to college. He closed with a wish to be remembered to various members of the family, especially the two youngsters, Mary and Jack. "Tell them I hope the progress they will make in their studies will be equal to my wishes." Also on July 2nd, Dearborn handed Lewis the authorization to select up to 12 non-commissioned officers and privates. He could pick them from the garrisons at the posts at Massac and Kaskaskia, the former on the lower Ohio and the latter on the Mississippi, above the mouth of the Ohio. In separate orders, Dearborn told the commanding officers at the posts to furnish Lewis with every assistance in selecting and engaging suitable men to accompany him on an expedition to the westward. That was a license to raid, sure to be resented by captains about to lose their best men, but Dearborn made it stick. "If any man in your company should be disposed to join Captain Lewis, and if Captain Lewis wanted the volunteer, you will detach them accordingly." In addition, Captain Russell Bissell at Kaskaskia was ordered to provide Lewis with the best boat on the post, and with a sergeant and 8 good men who understand rowing a boat. They would carry baggage for Lewis to his winter quarters on the Missouri, then descend before the ice closed in. Bissell refused Sergeant Patrick Gass's request to join the expedition, presumably on the grounds that he couldn't afford to lose his best non-commissioned officer. Lewis used the authority given him by Dearborn to enlist Gass anyway. For the descent of the Ohio, Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Cushing provided Lewis with 8 recruits from the post at Carlisle, Pennsylvania. In a pouch accompanying the order, Cushing included a couple of dozen letters for Lewis to deliver to officers at the western posts. He asked Lewis, after he reached St. Louis, to send the 8 recruits down the Mississippi to Fort Adams. Cushing closed with a nice note. "That your expedition may be pleasant to yourself and advantageous to our country, and when its toils and dangers are over, that you may enjoy many years of happiness, prosperity, and honor, is the sincere wish of, sir, your most obedient servant." July 4, 1803, the nation's 27th birthday, was a great day for Meriwether Lewis. He completed his preparations and was ready to depart in the morning. He got his letter of credit in its final form from President Jefferson, and the National Intelligencer of Washington reported in that day's issue that Napoleon had sold Louisiana to the United States. It was stunning news of the most fundamental importance. Henry Adams put it best. "The annexation of Louisiana was an event so portentous as to defy measurement. It gave a new face to politics and ranked in historical importance next to the Declaration of Independence and the adoption of the Constitution, events of which it was the logical outcome, but as a matter of diplomacy it was unparalleled because it costs almost nothing. Napoleon's decision to sell not just New Orleans but all of Louisiana and the negotiations that followed, and Jefferson's decision to waive his strict constructionist views in order to make the purchase, is a dramatic and well-known story. It is best described by Henry Adams in his History of the United States in the Administrations of Thomas Jefferson, one of the great classics of American history writing. Napoleon was delighted, and rightly so. He had title to Louisiana, but no power to enforce it. The Americans were sure to overrun it long before he could get an army there, if he ever could.
60 million francs for an occupation that will not perhaps last a day, he exulted.
He knew what he was giving up and what the United States was getting, and the benefit to France, beyond the money.
The sale assures forever the power of the United States, and I have given England a rival who, sooner or later, will humble her pride.
For Lewis, what mattered was not how Louisiana was acquired, a process in which he played no role, but that the territory he would be crossing from the Mississippi to the Continental Divide now belonged to the United States. As Jefferson nicely put it, the Louisiana Purchase lessened the apprehensions of interruption from other powers. The purchase did more for the expedition than relieve it of threats from the Spanish, French, or British. As Jefferson noted, it increased infinitely the interest we felt in the expedition. When Adams wrote that the purchase gave a new face to politics, he meant that it signified the end of the Federalist Party, which was so short-sighted and partisan that many of its representatives criticized the act. Alexander Hamilton was wise to content himself with remarking that Jefferson had just been lucky. The purchase, he said, resulted from the kind interpositions of an overruling providence. But a Boston Federalist newspaper did not like the deal at all. It called Louisiana a great waste, a wilderness unpeopled with any beings except wolves and wandering Indians. We are to give money of which we have too little for land of which we already have too much. Jefferson was risking